DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Hello and welcome to DW's Globalisation and Development Show, World in Progress. I'm Andre Leslie, sitting in this week for Anke Rasper. This week on the show, we learn of human rights improvements coming out of Myanmar.
Revolutions in Tunisia, Egypt, we heard the things. It become inspiration for us.
We hear about the worrying boom in child trafficking in Cameroon.
First have to communicate with your children and to let them know that things are very bad outside. They should watch out. They shouldn't talk to strangers. They shouldn't just talk to anybody.
And tough times in India as the country's ageing population struggles without state support.
A lot of people in the slum were handing over their documents to a local politician who promised he would get the work done, but nothing has happened so far.
But first to the ASEM 9 summit, a meeting of leaders from Asia and Europe, which has just concluded in the capital of Laos this week, Vientiane. The two-day talks there focused on economic cooperation between the two regions. But there's been another issue on the sidelines of the conference that has gone almost unreported. A small group of NGOs have accused the Laos government of hosting the event on grabbed land, an area that used to belong to farmers and fishermen who were moved on without consultation or proper reimbursement. I caught up with Ollie Courtney from Global Witness and asked him to sum up the situation in the Laos capital.
There's a small island in central Vientiane, which is called Don Chan, which is where leaders who were gathered for the ASEM summit, which is leaders from Asia and the EU, get together and talk about issues of mutual interest and concern. Now, they were staying in luxury villas that were built specifically for the conference. And that land, until very recently, used to belong to a small farming and fishing community who used to farm the land. They fished on the island, and they basically relied on that for everything. It was their source of food and income. They were kicked off the land without being properly consulted. They weren't given any right to refuse what happened. And today, they've been moved off their land and out of town to an area where they can't grow their crops in the way they used to. They're struggling to make ends meet, and they haven't been compensated properly for the land that they've lost. Sadly, this isn't an isolated case. This is a window onto a much wider problem.
How involved are European countries in land grabs in Asia?
The EU is one of the largest donors to that region. The EU gives about 12 million euros a year to promoting socio-economic development and human rights issues in Laos. And that money is designed to tackle these problems and to help the people of Laos lift them out of poverty. Now, it's very difficult for people who live on land and who rely on it for everything, for them to develop if they don't have their land anymore. So tackling this land grabbing crisis really is a matter of key concern for donors if they're going to make sure that the aid they're giving, these are taxpayer money after all, is effective and actually does what it's supposed to do.
How much land is being leased to foreigners in Asia generally? Do you have any figures on that?
Demand for land has increased significantly and rapidly in the last 10 years, really. And we have seen huge amounts of land, particularly in Cambodia, being transferred from small-scale farmers to large agribusiness companies. So I think it's about 54% of the total arable land in Cambodia has now been given to companies.
What do you think can be done to ensure that local people actually benefit from these land purchases? Is that possible at all?
Firstly, the main problem is that too many of these deals are too often done in secret, behind closed doors. The terms of what's happening aren't disclosed, and the people who are most affected aren't involved in the decision-making process. They're not given a say, they're just chucked off their land. So we need to end that culture of secrecy, and that applies both at the government end, so the government needs to be making efforts to make sure that proper infrastructure is in place to make those deals transparent. Companies also need to disclose the terms of the contracts that they're signing so that the people who are most affected can actually decide whether or not they want that deal to go through. There also needs to be other measures which would help bring people into decisions about how land is used. That communities need to be given access to what we call grievance mechanisms, so that's essentially a way of voicing their concern about these deals, and all too often that doesn't happen at present, and is one of the reasons why these deals can happen in the first place. And then the investment policies internationally and nationally really need to start finding ways to put the rights and needs of communities at the heart of these deals. And that's something that again, donors and international policymakers really need to be pressurizing the Lao and Cambodian governments to make sure that that's high on the agenda. They need to be asking those questions.
Now, just looking to the future, what do you think the trend is here? Do you think there's going to be more of this happening in the next few years, or federal governments in the region starting to become aware that they're being watched, that they're being reported on?
Well, sadly, at the moment, we certainly don't see the problem slowing down in this part of the world. If anything, it's increasing, and certainly in Cambodia, and there are signs of it in Laos as well. The government is increasingly acting like it can behave with impunity. What is good is that there does seem to be a growing awareness of how much of a problem this is and how much of an impact it's having on people. So attention does seem to be going up, but what's not happened so far is concrete action to deal with it and concrete pressure being put on the companies and the governments responsible to make sure this problem is sorted and that people who live on land and who want to see their countries develop and realise that that can actually land can be used in that way, they're actually seeing the benefits of those kind of investments. At the moment, that's not happening.
Ollie Courtney from Global Witness there, talking about locals who were relocated in Laos for the recently concluded ASEM conference. Now it's time for the Globalisation and Development News with Pavel Schrey.
Anti-Corruption Summit opens. The 15th International Anti-Corruption Conference has begun on Wednesday in the Brazilian capital, Brasilia. Speakers at the conference include Nobel Peace Prize laureate Tawakol Karman from Yemen, former president of South Africa Thabo Mbeki, and the executive director of Greenpeace Kumi Naidoo. The conference will look at how best to fight corruption in the areas of illegal flow of money, climate governance, political transition, impunity from the law, and clean sports. The conference was opened by Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. Human rights concerns continue in Tibet. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, has urged the Chinese government to address ongoing problems in Tibet. She says there has recently been an increase in desperate forms of protest in the region, including people setting themselves on fire. The High Commissioner said she was also disturbed by continuing allegations of violence against Tibetans seeking to exercise their fundamental human rights. She cited cases including that of a 17-year-old girl who was reportedly severely beaten and sentenced to 3 years in prison for distributing independence flyers. Other Tibetans have been sentenced to between 4 and 7 years in prison for writing essays, making films, or distributing photos. Malawi suspends anti-gay laws. Amnesty International has described Malawi's shelving of anti-gay laws as a historic step in the fight against discrimination in the country. Malawi's justice minister said that the laws are suspended until the parliament votes on them. During that time, police cannot arrest or prosecute homosexuals in the country. Same-sex relationships have until now been illegal in the Southern African nation and carry a penalty of up to 14 years in prison. Homosexuality is still illegal in many African countries. Cost of deforestation in Kenya. In Kenya, a landmark study has shown that the cost of deforestation greatly exceeds the economic benefit of the forestry industry by a factor of more than 4 to 1. The United Nations Environment Programme study found that in 2010, deforestation deprived Kenya's economy of 53 million euros, injecting only 12 million euros into the country. Deforestation affected Kenya's 5 montane forests, also called water towers, which store water during the rainy season and release it slowly, ensuring water flows during dry periods. Food cooperatives help poverty. Agricultural cooperatives can help end global hunger, according to the head of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Speaking recently in Manchester in England, Director General José Graciano da Silva said that cooperatives have an important role to play due to the fact that they give small-scale producers their best chance to compete in global markets. Da Silva said cooperatives can help small and medium-sized farms and fishing businesses to add value to their products and gain access to wider markets.
Pavel Schrey there with the Globalisation and Development News. To Myanmar now, formerly known as Burma, one of the poorest countries in Southeast Asia. Well, that status could be about to change soon, with both the World Bank and Asian Development Bank approving new loans to the country. Trips to the US by the President Thein Sein and opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi, along with the promise of democratic reforms, appear to have cleared the way for international trade and cooperation in the country. But after decades under a strict military regime, which infamously quashed the anti-government protests by monks in 2007, many locals are still apprehensive. Alice Klein went to the Myanmar capital, Yangon, to see how the country is faring.
In Yangon, capital city of Burma, the Southeast Asian country also known as Myanmar, prayer bells ring out at the Shwedagon Pagoda. Buddhism is widely followed here, and saffron-robed monks are a common sight on the streets as much as in the temples. Worshippers bring offerings of fresh jasmine and hit these bells so the gods pay attention to their prayers. Many are asking that the peace and democratic reforms sweeping the military-ruled country will last. Sing Sing, whose name has been changed for fear of reprisals, is a Burmese doctor. She believes the changes started around 9 months ago and have included improvements in workers' rights.
Yes, there is more activism, for example, like the foremost. They are allowed to express their feeling, okay, their rights to get back, you know, their lands, which are confiscated, you know, in the past by, you know, some of the cronies in collaboration with the military junta.
Like many others, Sing Sing says the internet and people's right to information has played a key role in opening up her country.
I think if more people have access to the outside world through the internet or through the YouTube or through the Facebook, or and then they can read, you know, different things, what's happening in the outside world, and by seeing the picture they can compare what's happening in the country and outside the country. At the same time, the population inside the country can also convey their, you know, feeling or their any message they want to send out to the international community. They can easily convey out to the world.
But Maung Loan, a former journalist, says the announcement that Burmese journalists no longer have to submit their stories to the government before publication is misleading.
The announcement is quite important, but it doesn't mean that we have full media rights. Doesn't mean that.
Maung Loan, also not his real name, agrees with Sing Sing that the changes are rooted in an emerging awareness of the outside world, and says the Arab Spring has had an impact on Burma.
When we listen to radio, we have a chance to know what's going on outside of the country, like revolutions in Tunisia, Egypt. We heard that things, it become inspiration for us, and we've been struggling for long, and these things, changes happening around the world. So that's the result of our struggle for 2 decades.
Maung Loan says journalists have been removed from the government's blacklist and independent media organisations are setting up in Yangon. This includes Democratic Voice of Burma, a group of video journalists who filmed the monks' protests of September 2007, named the Saffron Uprising, and were subsequently arrested.
Now you can see Democratic Voice of Burma open office here. Journalists are working and going into the parliament and interview the government officials. Now, in terms of this, I think there's huge progress in media. All the exile medias can come into Burma, open office, they run their publications, criticize the government openly. Now, I think regarding media, the progress is quite huge, I think, yes.
In other advances, in August, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Burma, lawyer Thomas Quintana, made his 6th trip to the country. He visited a number of prisons and agrees with activists that the remaining political prisoners must be freed immediately if the government is to truly change.
The president has released a lot of political prisoners in a process which is improving the numbers of political prisoners who now are on the streets. But according to my information, there are a lot of political prisoners who remain in jail.
Even when political prisoners are freed, there remains the issue of how to bring justice to the thousands of Burmese people who have been tortured and their families torn apart by decades of repression in a police state. Mr. Quintana has one idea.
The widespread and systematic human rights abuses from the past will definitely come back to the present and to the future in Myanmar, if anything, any measure is being taken in this respect.
The tricky question of how to deal with Burma's painful past aside, Mr. Quintana is convinced the future looks bright for Burma. He believes recent trips to the US by Aung San Suu Kyi and the president, Ten Sen, were about international diplomacy rather than public relations. Undeniably, Sen's trip also resulted in trade improvements with the US, with Europe having already lifted trade sanctions. So now, after decades of repression, Burma's people are determined to grasp this opportunity and make the changes talked about on Western TV screens a reality in their country.
Alice Klein reporting from Myanmar there. You're listening to DW's Globalisation and Development show, World in Progress.
Through the fire and the chains, we're gonna get in the light. The shining light upon our way is making in a life out of this. Through the fire and the chains, we're gonna get in a life out of this.
And that was Fritz Kalkbrenner's tune, Get a Life. More of that at the end of the show. But before then, we're off to Africa, where trafficking in children is becoming an increasing concern in Cameroon. Although exact figures are unknown, every day there are reports of children taken away from their homes to unknown destinations. The children are often abducted by strangers or taken away under agreed terms by respected people in society, who end up not respecting their own part of the bargain. According to the International Criminal Police Organisation Interpol, Cameroon is both a destination and a transit point for child trafficking, with over 4 million children trafficked in the region every year. Gala Chilean Chimtom has this report from the capital, Yaoundé.
Until a year ago, Christopher Neba used to live an enjoyable family life with his family of six in a small town in Cameroon. Then on a Sunday he will never forget, one of his children was abducted. Christopher was taking an afternoon sleep when a neighbor's child rushed in to say that a stranger had just gone off with his seven-year-old's daughter, neighbor Beltinlum.
I thought somebody in the quarter will bring along the child. At the end, the whole quarter was gathered in my door and nobody was with the child. The next day, I headed to police stations. Till today, I have not seen a message that such a child is living somewhere.
Christopher now believes that one of his neighbors might have been involved in his daughter's abduction. The perpetrators might still contact the family, he says, but there is not much hope. Traffickers don't only abduct children by force in Cameroon. Sometimes they prey on the gullible nature of the parents. These sorts of traffickers are often people well known to the communities of the victims. Laura Tufoin is the coordinator of the Ecumenical Service for Peace, a religious group that has carried out extensive studies on child trafficking in Cameroon.
What we have noticed with those involved in this heinous exercise is that they are people well known in the communities where they go for the victim, respectable people with very high professional backgrounds. They come to the communities and then they get the children, promise the families or the communities that they're going to give a better life for the children. But unfortunately, the family hardly ever asks the contact of these people who come to take the children. And so they end up not tracing their children.
It seems that many parents here tend to trust anybody who is wealthy enough to give their kids a better life. That is why they will give out their kids to unknown people without taking the extra care to understand their exact destinations. In a country where 40% of the people live below the poverty line, such trust is perhaps understandable. Tufoin says many of these children, most of them girls, end up as house helps, babysitters or prostitutes. She also suspects that some are maybe killed so that their internal organs can be used to transplants in medical operations. According to the International Police Organization Interpol, Cameroon is both a source and a destination for child trafficking, with networks extending far across the country's borders. Laura Tufoin recounts the story of a notorious child trafficker who took children from Nigeria and brought them into Cameroon.
There was somebody who took as a habit bringing young girls with their children, or a young girl who is pregnant. And when this girl arrives Cameroon, the child either disappears and the girl is forced back, or when the girl puts to birth, they tell her that the baby died and she's forced to go back. Don't ask me what they are doing with these babies, but that is a reality.
Very few of these cases are followed up by the police, a force ill-equipped to investigate complex or multinational criminal issues. Tufoin says some cases even involve influential people who have the financial might to bribe the police. Parents are trying to adopt strategies to keep their kids safe. Comfort Sue is a housewife in Yaoundé who knows the risk of letting children loose.
First have to communicate with your children and to let them know that things are very bad outside. They should watch out. They shouldn't talk to strangers. They shouldn't just talk to anybody. If at the end of classes the parents don't come and take them, they should wait inside the schoolyard.
A first meeting on how to tackle the problem of child trafficking was recently organized by Interpol in the Cameroon capital, Yaoundé. Conrad Atsefo-Tsefo, an officer in Interpol's Regional Bureau for Central Africa, sums up the substance of the discussions.
We propose for the member countries to organize police operations on this phenomenon. We also solicited that the issue of child trafficking should be considered a crime in the countries.
In addition, Conrad believes there is a need to sensitize families and communities to the issue and that community leaders also have a role to play. Critics say that a child protection policy for Cameroon should also be drawn up as soon as possible. Meanwhile, Christopher Neba still does not know where his daughter is and whether she is still alive. He admits that he has now become suspicious of almost everybody, even his closest neighbors. The fear of losing another child has made him extra careful, but memories of his lost child continue to torment him.
Gala Chilean Chimtom there, reporting from Cameroon. India's population is getting older at an alarming rate. According to a recent report by the United Nations Population Fund, the country has over 90 million people above the age of 60, more than the current total population of Germany. And this number is set to soar to over 320 million by the year 2050. With few government policies in place to take care of them, the majority of India's elderly live in poverty, with little access to quality health care or even basic necessities. This problem is especially acute for women. They face issues of discrimination, neglect, and often exploitation. Pia Chandavaka has more.
The traffic is deafening on this arterial road in the South Indian city of Coimbatore. The sun beats down on the hot tarmac. Cars and motorbikes whiz past, honking impatiently. 75-year-old Nachamma weaves her way slowly through the chaos, inching forward with her broken-down pushcart. The tires of the cart are long worn out.
I find it very difficult on a road like this because I need a lot of strength and I have to walk faster as I come down the slope. Thankfully, people sometimes stop and help.
Nachamma puts on a brave face. Her back is bent with age. Her hands and feet are crooked with arthritis. She takes several breaks on the way as she pushes her cart to a nearby girls' school where she sells sweets and snacks. The 2 kilometer journey from home takes her nearly half an hour. Once at the school, Nachamma opens her cart and lays out her wares. Sweet limes, guavas spiced with salt and chili powder, and savory snacks. As Nachamma waits patiently outside the school gate, the bell rings and the children come streaming out. Today's takings are lower than usual. 30 rupees, that's just over 40 cents. On a better day, she makes around 1 euro. Since her husband Balasubramaniam passed away, this has been Nachamma's life for the past 10 years. With no social security or financial assistance, she is forced to work for a living. Since she can no longer afford to pay rent, she lives in a small thatched hut in a city slum. Old people's homes in the city are rare anyway. Most families here are expected to look after their elderly family members themselves. Of her two sons, one died of a prolonged illness, and another works as a labourer. But Nachamma says she can't ask him for financial help. The majority of Indians do not receive an old age pension unless they have worked in the government sector. Under a special scheme in her local area, Nachamma is entitled to a monthly pension of 1,000 rupees, around 14 euro. She says it has been more than a year since she applied for it, but she hasn't started receiving any money yet.
I couldn't go to the government office personally because I find it difficult to walk so far or get on a bus. A lot of people in the slum were handing over their documents to a local politician who promised he would get the work done. So I did the same, but nothing has happened so far.
A government ration card would also help Nachamma get subsidized food grain and other supplies. But she was told by government officials that widows cannot get one. A few kilometers away, in a village at the outskirts of the city, another widow goes about her daily work. 65-year-old Saina Bibi makes flower garlands to be sold outside temples. A local contractor has the flowers delivered to her one-room apartment in the morning and picks up the completed garlands in the evening.
These are basil leaves, these are oleanders, and these are chrysanthemums.
The delivery boy hands Saina Bibi 500 rupees, around 7 euros, which is her monthly pay. With this, she has to pay her rent and the electricity bill. That leaves very little for her other needs. But she says this is the only work she has ever known. Saina Bibi married before she reached her teens, and her husband died 13 years later.
My husband always took good care of me. After he was gone, I didn't want to get married to anyone else. Even if I did decide to get married, there would have been no men willing to marry me because I didn't have any money.
Being a widow since the age of 25 has not been easy for Saina Bibi. With no children of her own, she lives alone since the death of her mother 8 years ago. She suffers from high blood pressure and needs medication. Like Nachamma, she has no access to subsidized food under the public distribution system. Some days, she has to make do with almost nothing at all. Still, Saina Bibi says she does not fear for the future.
What is there to fear? I can only do the best I can while I'm still alive. And when it's my turn to die, I just want to go peacefully.
In the future, Nachamma and Saina Bibi both hope for financial assistance from the government or other charity organizations in order to survive. As the elderly population in India continues to grow, theirs is a problem that will affect millions of others as well.
Pia Chandavarkar there, reporting from the southern Indian city of Coimbatore. And sadly, that's all we have time for this week. If you'd like to read more stories on globalization and development, or you'd like to listen to the show again, please head to our website, www.dw.de/globalization, with a Z. Or you can get in contact on Twitter. Just search for our account, DW_global. You've been listening to World in Progress. Our studio technician for today's show was Xenia Denchik. The studio manager was Jesse Wingard, and I've been Andre Leslie. We look forward to having you back next week. Out of this.
break the road by walking. Find a place that is right.